Hey everybody, welcome back to Rock Under Fire. It's our first show for 2018, and I don't know if this is quite going to make it as an official episode, because this is actually a test. And what I mean by that is I'm recording this on Monday, January 16th. Just to give you some perspective on how we usually do our episodes, we usually record and the episodes aren't released until about anywhere from a day or two up to maybe a week after we record. We started to do this last night. It was the first time that we kind of assembled for 2018 after having done our Christmas episode back in mid-December. And we took a month off and we started to do the show last night, Pat and Stick and myself. And we ran into some technical difficulties. And, you know, we're a low-budget podcast. That's no secret. We don't get any ad revenue. We don't ask for money from our listeners. We, you know, as far as listener support, we don't have a big audience. You know, we're about 2 years into our show, almost 2 years, but we kind of mark our seasons with the new year. So this is actually, we're going into, I guess, what we would call season three. You know, the show is recorded on a laptop. And I do all the editing and the mixing, and I work, you know, through our media host to get it out on iTunes and Stitcher and wherever else it goes. I know we're on YouTube also, but I kind of put that up separately. So we ran into some issues last night, and I had to troubleshoot. I had to do some troubleshooting with our software. So my co-hosts are not with me right now. Like I said, this is going to be the test, but we just lost Dolores O'Riordan. At least, I guess going back to 2016, we're losing people. I mean, they're dropping like flies. And I always say rock's first and second generations. You know, anybody between that's in their 60s and 70s and 80s, and a few in their 50s. Prince. Chris Cornell, way too young. And these things are expected, that people in the first and second generations of rock, it's going to be a regular thing. And it's something we've been talking about. And it seems that every time we get back together every other week to do a new episode, we're left with some sort of discussion with who we lost that particular week. But this is 46 years old, man. I'm older than her, you know. And when I think about how young she was, I remember back in the 90s, my generation, you know, Pat, Stick, you know, our entire group of friends, we're all pretty much the same age, give or take a few years. And I remember thinking when we lost Kurt Cobain, he was 27, I was 24. We're roughly the same generation, but those guys, you know, the grunge artists, they were all about 3-4 years older than us. So they're, you know, they had pretty much crossed into their 50s had Kurt lived. Chris Cornell, I think, was 50. So it really surprised me how young she was. I mean, she joined the Cranberries, I think she was 18. And by the time that they broke really big in 93-94, you know, that means she was about 23 years old. Not too much is known at this point. I mean, the news is pretty much 5 hours old, 5 or 6 hours old at this point. And it was something that I wasn't really going to post. I mean, I saw a few things on Facebook earlier, and I didn't see that they were from really reputable sites. I'll look for a Rolling Stone article, or I'll look for something from the New York Times before I realize that it's not a hoax and that it has in fact been confirmed. Lindsay Holmes, her publicist, did confirm it. I mean, the news came directly from her through an email. Dolores was recording. She was in London for some recording session. People magazine is already talking about her depression and an alleged suicide attempt. It's something that we know she struggled with depression. She was diagnosed as bipolar a few years back, but we don't want to go there. You know, I mean, obviously, you know, you start thinking things, all kind of speculation on various things. I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to go anywhere. As I got, you know, the New York Times in front of me, the Dolores O'Riordan, lead singer of the Irish rock band, the Cranberries. Her death was announced by her publicist, who did not specify the cause. Statement said that family members are devastated to hear the breaking news and have requested privacy at this very difficult time. She was big on family. I mean, her kids, I mean, she had, her biggest fear was something happening to her three kids. And, you know, once asked, you know, what her favorite sound is, she said, well, besides silence, the laughter of children on a playground. And that says it all. She, you know, her hero and one of her, you know, she was very close with her mother. And she had gone through a divorce around 2013, 2014. And I know there was an incident where she was arrested on a flight from New York back to Ireland. And she had just, you know, quote unquote, verbally and physically abusive on an airplane. And later diagnosed as bipolar. So it was kind of attributed to that. And again, she struggled with depression and had a prior nervous breakdown, from what I understand, that she did talk about. The initial, I guess the first 10 years following her success, and that being the 90s into the turn of the decade, where it really had a very negative effect on her, and it caused her to have a nervous breakdown. I don't know how much any of this is going to play into what happened. Given the nature of the beast in stardom and celebrity, although I guess she kind of flew under the celebrity radar, but that type of stardom and success and just the constant movement and just you know, somebody else with the foot to the pedal and you can't control it, you know, you the field and the need to get off the train at some point. Given the nature of that and seeing what it does to people in so many, you know, countless numbers throughout rock history, right up to Chris Cornell, I would not be surprised if that somehow had some sort of plays into what happened to her today. Born on September 6, 1971, she lived in Buckhorn, Ontario, although she was back and forth. I mean, she had lived in Ireland for a great number of years. After her divorce, she had, you know, her summer home in Ontario. I guess that became her permanent residence. Cranberry split up around 2009. I know they reunited in the last, there was a reunion in the last 3 or 4 years, and she had formed another project called Dark, D-A-R-K, around 2000. I guess pretty quickly after the Cranberries, and she formed that with Andy Rourke of the Smiths, former Smiths bassist. She was an honorary patron of the University of Philosophical Science at Trinity College in Dublin. One of the things that struck me, they asked her once, because I was looking, you know, I was just kind of watching some footage of her as I was waiting for my Windows 10 updates to happen, which took about 3 hours, if she could come back reincarnated. And I've been asked this question myself, so it was kind of pleasant. I was kind of pleasantly surprised when she said she would come back as something that flew, something that flies, a bird, she said. And just, you know, in fun conversations with people, you know, that question has come to me, you know, if you could come back, if you could be reincarnated as anything, what would it be? And I always say a bird, because I'd like to be a bird. I'd like to fly, you know, just the freedom, the symbolic freedom that birds represent, you know, the eagle, America. So, I mostly associate her with Zombie, and to me, it's the last great anti-war song written in the rock era, and she belonged to. I'll go two places with this. She belonged to that era, the last relevant, important era or should I say the last relevant phase of the rock era. Wasn't grunge, but she belonged to that period where rock was still flourishing and the majority of the massive artists were rock artists. And you just don't have that today. You know, they were at Woodstock 94 and they played in front of that massive crowd at Woodstock 94. At the time, I was very much against that concert. I was 24, knew everything. So it was just, to me, it just represented just the ugliest aspects of capitalism. And I remember referring to it as Pepsi Stock 94, how you could take something as sacred as Woodstock and just totally commercialize it. But the fact that most of those artists on that bill were rock artists, and most of them, the majority of them were big, could handle themselves and support themselves on, you know, headline tours in massive venues. And it was a celebration. It was this big mix of rock and roll's past and rock and roll's present, present being 1994 at the time. You see festivals today, and there's just so many more festivals now than there were 24 years ago. But the majority of those festivals, if you get 100 names on those bills, maybe only three or four are big enough to fill a stadium. And that's the difference between today and what it was during that period of time where, you know, the Cranberries were, you know, their, I say short-lived success, but I mean, they were successful. They had an audience. There are people who are crushed today. I'm reading a lot of the comments that I'm getting in my notifications for our own page. And so there were fans out there that did follow her career. I kind of lost touch. I mean, I really wasn't. I can't honestly sit here and say that I was a big Cranberries fan. I got to see her once, you know, way back in the day, around 95. In fact, it was 95 because it was right after Jerry Garcia died. I think it was actually the same week. And back in that period of time, she really existed in that last significant phase of rock and roll. And a lot of the stuff that we talk about on this podcast is related to that. How do we reconcile the idea that rock is this ongoing thing and it's just as big, just as relevant today as it ever was and that it was back then, and the bands are there, you just have to look for them? I don't buy it. I respect that. I respect that idea, but I don't buy it. There's nothing substantial enough to support such a statement, such a belief. Yeah, there's great stuff out there, but you know, it's not leaving any. Let's stop the word relevant because I've used it enough today. It's just not leaving any. It's not making a cultural impact on influential impact on the present or the future that we know of. Oh man, this is what I get when I take a chance, and it looks like I'm going over 15 minutes, and we couldn't really make it past 10 minutes last night, so it looks like our software is working, so I guess I'll just keep going, and you guys, if you're still listening, actually find out before my own co-hosts do that I'm doing the show, that I'm flying solo here. The second place I wanted to go regarding that period of time where she existed in rock's last significant phase of the rock era. Let's take a song like Zombie. Apparently it was a response and a reaction against a terrorist attack in 1993 done by the Irish Republican Army. According to the New York Times, I don't have the thing in front of me. I found this surprising. This was, let me reread this here. She was the sole writer of the Noisier, Angrier Zombie, a response to an Irish Republican Army terrorist bombing in 1993. I mean, I know she mentions 1916. Not really looking into the historical implications of Zombie. It's not surprising. It's really not surprising. I mean, U2 had taken on similar subject matter, Sunday Bloody Sunday. So I just didn't really look at it as a song that was rooted in the present as she wrote that song, you know, in connection. And now it's just kind of like, duh. Like, yeah. if anybody remembers, and I remember it well, you know, in the 90s, you had, in much the same way as the Middle East is such a breeding ground for terrorism today. And it's just, you can't avoid it. It's just in the news. It's become such an issue that's been pushed to the forefront in the last few decades. You had the Irish Republican Army, and you had a lot of problems in the early 90s between Britain and Northern Ireland. Terrorism was a regular thing. I mean, I remember Bill Clinton going through taking a lot of shit because John Major, who was the British Prime Minister at the time, and he didn't talk to Bill Clinton for a while because when Gerry Adams was granted a visa, the U.S. granted Gerry Adams a visa, and he came to the United States and met with Bill Clinton. Gerry Adams was the leader of Sinn Féin, and Sinn Féin was the political arm, the political wing of the Irish Republican Army. And he came to the United States at the opposition. A lot of people were opposed to it. I mean, Ted Kennedy even opposed it at first. I mean, initially, it wasn't a very popular move on the part of the United States or Bill Clinton. Eventually, it was all in the name of peace talks. And I guess they negotiated over the course of the next few years, and, you know, it resulted in the Belfast Agreement. That's neither here nor there. I don't want to get into politics. And I'll leave it at that. But a song like Zombie, you know, written, if it had been an American artist written, I mean, it could never be written in 2017, given the climate in the United States and the rabid response of the right. It's just their overall hostility toward anybody that speaks their mind. Toward anything that they disagree with. And it's just a really disgusting, ugly way to react to people speaking their minds in the freest country in the world. And that's just sad. And I once had Zombie was once included on a compilation. I bought this one. There was this one compilation I bought around 10 years ago. And it was I bought it for like, it was like $6. It was a double, it was two CDs on I'll never remember the name of it. It was just like this really cheaply made compilation of folk music. It was mostly folk music, but the theme of it was anti-war songs. And so it goes back to, you know, If I Had a Hammer and, you know, Peter, Paul, and Mary, you know, like all of this, like mostly dominated by folk music. And the most recent one in the middle of this thing, or I guess at the tail end of it, was this, and I'll never remember the artist, was this folky version of Zombie. And that's when the song really, you know, when it hit me what the song was, what I thought the song was about. But I guess I never really focused on what it really was. And I guess if the New York Times is right, she was writing about current events. And it's from her country to ours, you know. Great art inspires, great art makes connections, and I'll always remember her and that band for that song. I know they had a handful of other ones, Linger, and, you know, like I said, I wasn't a big fan. I guess when I first heard her voice, she kind of, in a way, and some people will be horrified by this, but she had a quality in her voice that was very reminiscent of Sinead O'Connor. If you listen to the first Sinead O'Connor album, The Lion and the Cobra, you'll hear the similarities. She had that, you know, Dolores had that yelpy, yodeling voice, a very soft voice, very, when she spoke, it was very trebly, almost like she had like a permanent cold that she couldn't get rid of. But when she roared, man, when she could roar like a lion, and it was that quality in her voice that kind of, when I first heard the Cranberries, it reminded me. I think I might have even thought it was Sinead, I hate to say, because after, I didn't hear the Cranberries until after that whole incident at the Garden when Sinead O'Connor was booed off the stage, and that happened in 92, and the Cranberries broke like about a year and a half after, I think. I might be wrong. And then there was that softness to her voice that when, you know, I used to confuse the Cranberries with the Sundays. And I had an ex-girlfriend at the time who was listening to both the Cranberries and the Sundays. So I was like, which one is this? Is it the Cranberries or the Sundays? Is it the Sundays or the Cranberries? So, yeah, you know, I don't know if I guess I should maybe wrap this up. This is, I guess, wasn't intended to be an episode, but I guess I'll leave it at that. And just to reiterate what's going on here, if you've made it this far into our, what is now episode 39 of Rock Under Fire. Rock Under Fire is a rock and roll podcast. And we go back, we started around April 2016. And I have two co-hosts normally. Now, this is not for all you listeners who are normally, you know, constantly listen to us. I mean, listen, I appreciate your support. We appreciate your support. Keep listening. But right now, I'm just going to kind of address anybody who may be joining us for the first time. We're a rock and roll podcast, and we started out in April 2016. And this is episode 39. We're bi-weekly. We discuss all seven decades of rock and roll, which means that we really have our work cut out for us to find our audience. And there are metalheads out there who feel that we rely too much on classic rock, and there are fans of classic rock who feel we rely too much, you know, that we talk too much about metal. There are people, you know, Bob Dylan fans and who say, why do you have to talk about metal so much? And why, what's what all this? And then there are fans of rock who think we should be talking about artists who nobody's heard of and just focus on new music and some of that new music that not a lot of people have heard, bands that pretty much play clubs because there really isn't a large audience for rock and roll anymore. Let's face it, you know, it was once the cultural zeitgeist. It was once everything. It once informed our way of life. It reflected politics. It reflected the state of the world. It informed fashion trends. And that was part of a rock era that largely existed between 1954 and 1994. And I say 94 not for any particular reason, but a lot of people who write about rock and roll and talk about rock and roll in depth often use the death of Kurt Cobain as a marker, as a dividing line. Nothing really significant that caused anything, but it just kind of serves as a marker for the past and the present. Everything kind of that happened after that, after 94, give or take a few years, was kind of reactionary, was reactive to everything that happened in the early part of the 90s. And we never really recovered. Rock never evolved. Rock has been looking backwards for the past 25 years. And a friend of mine once told me recently in a debate / argument that, you know, a culture looking backwards is stagnant. Well, hell yeah, because the culture, has been looking backwards as far as the rock bands, because new rock music is only good, let's face it, because it sounds old. Have you heard this band? They sound just like you too. Have you heard this band? They sound just like the Stones. Have you heard this band? I love this. It reminds me of early Replacements. Rock and roll has not made an impact in about 25 years. So we look at those things. I kind of take the phrase rock is dead. And we look at it. We don't actually believe rock is dead. Of course, fucking rock, there's a lot of rock and roll out there. But I often play devil's advocate, and I take that statement. We turn it on its head. We turn it upside down, inside out, break it apart, look at it, dissect it, analyze it, and try to really, really just assess rock's place in the 21st century. What is rock's place in the 21st century? So that's basically the gist of our show. We understand that not everybody is going to like every episode. You know, sometimes we talk about Judas Priest and sometimes we don't. Sometimes we talk about Bob Dylan and sometimes we don't. We've had a few guests on our show. Every once in a while, we have some friends join us. But I'll tell you what, you'll never be bored. If you're new to the show, you will never be bored because we take we have good content. That's one thing. We may not have the audience that I want, that I would have liked to have had at this point, but I think that's a matter of promotion and just finding a way through social media to reach as many, to reach a whole lot more people. And again, I'm not a social media expert. I'm just, you know, this is a labor of love. We are not critics. We're not journalists. We're just three rock fans who decided to plug in some microphones into a mixer and run it into a laptop and, you know, on some free recording software and have a discussion every other week because we have that kind of chemistry. And it's not for the faint of heart. It's not for people who... one of the early criticisms was you guys should not talk so long because people who like to listen to podcasts, they have short attention spans. They're on their way to work. They were like 10 minutes, 20 minutes at the most. People don't have, well, you know what? Our target audience is people like us who like to dissect rock and roll music, like to talk in depth. The geeks, the ones who want to talk about those rare, you know, the not the hit songs, but the obscure song on side two of Exile on Main Street, and we, you know, so we're three music geeks talking about rock and roll music. It's nothing original. There are thousands and thousands of podcasts out there. People who do what we do, you know, three, four people, sometimes two people. Some podcasts focus on one rock group. Some podcasts, they focus on albums. We have a very, very big task of just trying to contain it all in 7 decades. That's a lot of music. So, again, if you're new to the show, subscribe to us on YouTube. Subscribe to us on iTunes, download our show. I promise you, you will never be bored. You may not actually agree with most of what we say, a lot of it, but I promise you will never be bored. Our content is impeccable. We've scratched the surface. I mean, dig into our archives. There are some really, really good shows, and some of it is... You know, we kind of go, I like to say we straddle the line of Howard Stern meets Charlie Rose. Now, Charlie Rose is getting a bad rap, but what I mean by that is just serious and academic in nature. And, you know, sometimes we're crazy. Sometimes it's just real scathing and biting. And just, again, we're just three fucking clowns. And when it's time to get serious, we do. So with that, I'll leave it at that. Rock Under Fire on iTunes, Rock Under Fire on Facebook, Rock Under Fire on Twitter, Rock Under Fire on YouTube, and I'll just keep going if you want, but, you know, you get the idea. Mike Jericho here. That's episode 39. We'll see you next time. Pouring on me, bad news keep pouring on me, bad.